Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, an Obamacare milestone, GM grilled, the Supreme Court on money and politics, and another Fort Hood shooting. The president pugnacious on his health care reform.
Despite several lost weeks out of the gate because of problems with the website, 7.1 million Americans have now signed up for private insurance plans through these marketplaces.
GM's Mary Barra in recall hearings spluttering under pressure from Texas Republican Joe Barton.
With all respect,
you
just answered is gobbledygook.
And the all-too-familiar first word of a shooter at Fort Hood.
Senator Onyanis, just advise, we have an active shooter currently on Fort Hood coming in from the motor pool area. Classified from a vehicle, dark Toyota Camry.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with John McCormick of the Weekly Standard, Kristen Welker of NBC, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your top story this week? What do you make of the High Court's decision on campaign donations? Where do you think Obamacare stands? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is John McCormick, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. John, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be here.
Wonderful to have you. Also with us from Washington, Kristen Welker, White House correspondent for NBC News. Kristen, great to have you here today.
Tom, thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, former longtime Atlantic Monthly editor, author of The Rascal King, The Age of Betrayal, The Lost History of 1914, public thinker and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack. Great to have you here.
Hello, Tom, John, and Kristen.
Listen, it is great to sit down and look at this week's news, but the punctuation on this week has been the shooting at Fort Hood, and it's just so sad to see this come into the heart of such a big military base once again. Kristen Welker, what can we learn from what we know so far about this man, this particular soldier, and what's going on in the U.S. military where we're now having to look at the second such attack at Fort Hood?
Right. I think there's a sense of how could this have happened again, certainly, in terms of the man, Ivan Lopez, 15 years of military service, spent 4 months in Iraq. And we know that he was being treated for depression, for anxiety. He was being reviewed for potentially having PTSD, although that had not been determined. And there may have been some type of altercation before the shooting started. But a lot of people are so confused. This is a family man. He had four kids. They're saying there weren't signs that he was violent. So military officials are calling for a review. And you'll recall in the wake of the shooting at the Navy Yard, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said that there needed to be a review of security measures. And so there is a sense that that might need to be revisited, a review of security measures at military installations throughout the country, and also a review of mental health services. You heard President Obama talking about that we need to do a better job of caring for our returning vets. One thing that you're not hearing is a revival of the debate over gun control. There seems to be more of a focus on prevention here, mental health services.
This was his own gun, not military issue. At a news conference yesterday, we heard Lieutenant General Mark Milley, Commander of 3rd Corps in Fort Hood. He was asked if Ivan Lopez had been receiving the mental health care that he needed.
I've asked for external investigators to come in to help us with all of that, to ensure that there's no gaps or seams. We do know that he was under treatment, so he was in the system, and he was being looked at.
John McCormick, 4 months in Iraq. He told superiors when he came back that he had a traumatic head injury, but here reports are quoting officials saying that he had not seen combat. There was no record of that. He had been at Fort Bliss, where we've heard a Republican Congresswoman Kay Granger complain bitterly. She said last year she was ashamed of the dozens of reports from soldiers at Fort Bliss saying they had to struggle to get proper care even when they felt they were falling apart. Danny Zwerdling reporting that for NPR. What about the quality of care that we're giving our returned soldiers, John? Is that an issue here?
I think certainly. I mean, there's a lot of details that we don't yet know. But we do know that our troops have not always gotten the best care, whether it's mental health care or even just normal health care, when they return from service. As you said, you know, he hadn't seen combat, but he was in Iraq. He reported a brain injury. We'll see what emerges. And as Christian pointed out, it was a typical handgun, so it wasn't one of these assault weapons. So this really hasn't reignited the gun control debate. But we are just do need to look and see if we're doing a good enough job in caring for our troops. And in many cases, that just isn't the case. Whether this particular case, he fell through the cracks, so I think we'll need to really see the evaluation first before we make that conclusion.
Jack Beatty, the point being made again and again here is we have so many troops who have come home from repeated deployments abroad in the last decade. When they get home, they would like to feel, they need to feel safe. And here in the heart of this very big military base, it just hasn't been so.
There's no safety anywhere, seems to be the moral. You know, the one certain result of this Fort Hood shooting is that fear is almost certainly to move more Americans to buy guns. Even the military is at risk. It happened after Newtown. It'll probably happen now. You know, last week, Georgia may have unveiled the American future when the legislature passed a bill that allows guns virtually everywhere, from maternity wards to funerals, from airports to bars. And the Georgia legislators took their text from the NRA. The only thing that'll stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And last week, too, the week before, rather, NRA lobbying panicked Democratic senators into rejecting President Obama's nominee for the Surgeon General. His offense, he said, that guns can be hazardous to health. The gall of the man. You know, the NRA rules it won't rest until all the good guys have guns. Then every good guy will confront a new threat, the bad guy inside, armed and dangerous.
Kristen, have you heard anything on the military front about how they plan to deal with this? I mean, obviously, they want to try and get people psychologically well-centered. And I don't know how you control guns on a base the size of Fort Hood. Their own guns they can lock up, and they know when they're issued, and they know to whom. But can you imagine the U.S. military somehow emerging as a leader in controls on guns within its boundaries?
Well, and that's one of the aspects of this that's so interesting, that you have people coming out and saying it's just so, it would be so difficult to search everyone on these military installations.
So big, we're talking 70, 80,000, 90,000 people every day there.
Exactly. They say it would just not be feasible. Having said that, Secretary Hagel said something clearly went wrong, an indication that he's not satisfied with the security measures that are in place. I yesterday asked White House Press Secretary Jay Carney if there needed to be a review of security measures on these military installations. And he said, look, it's just too early to get into that. But I would be surprised if this didn't reignite some type of a review process about how we're securing these military installations, because this keeps happening. And there's almost a concern that when you have a base as large as Fort Hood, that it almost becomes a target. So I think that's another question mark that they're going to be looking at when they ask themselves how this happened and how this could have been prevented.
And most disconcertingly, a target from within. Listeners, military listeners in particular, were eager to hear your perspective on what we have seen late this week at Fort Hood. I want to look at the Affordable Care Act, health care reform as well. President Obama out this week claiming some kind of victory, though there is a lot still in play here on health care reform. But he was in a feisty mood in the Rose Garden on Tuesday, saying that over 7 million people had signed up for coverage under the new health care exchanges. The president slammed critics of the Affordable Care Act.
Why are folks working so hard for people not to have health insurance? Why are they so mad about the idea of folks having health insurance? Many of the tall tales that have been told about this law have been debunked. There are still no death panels. Armageddon has not arrived.
John McCormick, long angry silences between those sentences at a Rose Garden celebration. What do you say to his question, John? Why are folks working so hard for people not to have health insurance?
Well, I don't think they are. I think we need to look at this in perspective. What the 7 million figure means is that the website at the end of the day ended up working well enough to perform about what is expected. Now we're going to have the debate that we expected to have all along is whether or not this was worth it, whether it was not worth upending the previous system for the new system. I mean, you canceled 5+ million health plans. Those people had nowhere to go but Obamacare. What we know is that of that 7 million, maybe 2 to 3 million of those people were previously uninsured. That's about 1% of the U.S. population, a little more than 5% of the uninsured population. So it's really not a huge dent in the current uninsured population. I think going forward, the political question, the politics of Obamacare, whether this law succeeds or fails, is going to basically fall on the question of, does this law hurt more people than it helps? And how much does it hurt those it hurts? And how much does it help those it helps? If you look at the polls right now, the latest one from Gallup, this was back in March, it says, has the law, the health care law, hurt you or your family or helped you or your family? And the number was 23% hurt versus 10% helped. Now, maybe that number will close a little bit. Maybe it will increase. I could see that it will actually maybe close a little bit after this success. Maybe the media influence will influence that number a little bit. But in the long run, you're going to see these Medicare Advantage cuts. Maybe they're not death panels. Maybe someone's not out there, you know, saying you live, you die. But definitely, we're going to see more people feeling the pain of the way this law was paid for, which was, you know, reshuffling and making some people pay more so some people could pay less. Whether this works out on net to be a popular thing remains to be seen. Right now, it still isn't. And I don't expect it to be, certainly not in the next year.
Kristen, when do we know if this health care reform, big as it is up, in gear, inevitable, irreversible?
Well, already there is a sense that it's going to be impossible to repeal the law. And I've been speaking to White House officials who've been working on health care who say we're going to get the actual figures about how many of those 7 million people followed through with, sent in their checks, finished the enrollment process. What percentage of those are young, healthy people? Those figures are going to be key, of course. But look, this is a political reset for President Obama, but also for Democrats, because this was really their Achilles heel in 2014. It still is, of course, to some extent. I don't think you're going to see President Obama campaigning with Mark Begich in Alaska, for example, as he fights to hold on to his seat. Having said that, it gives Democrats a little bit more leverage as they go out onto the campaign trail to say, look, this wasn't the complete disaster that we thought
it looked
going
like
to
so
be
recently, at
ago.
Least this week. Kristen Welker, John McCormick, Jack Beatty, stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news, another Fort Hood shooting, another Supreme Court ruling on money and politics, GM, Obamacare, and Mideast talks at an impasse this week. David Letterman on his way out. Kristen Welker joins us, White House correspondent for NBC News with us from Washington. John McCormick, senior writer for the Weekly Standard with us as well. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty is here. If the heat is still on Obamacare, if it's still on trial, Republicans eager to say this week that they aren't the party of no about it. Bobby Jindal in particular, Republican of Louisiana, saying he's got an alternative. Bobby Jindal.
We're not just the party of no. We've got good ideas. I formed a group called America Next that's out there putting out detailed policy solutions on health care. What's the alternative to replacing Obamacare once we do need to repeal it?
John McCormick, how do you see, apart from campaigning against Obamacare, which is well underway already, and no doubt we'll see more, what about this notion of a Republican alternative? If it's not repealable, how would that happen? What's the, you know, not the party of no message going to be?
Well, you have to have a replacement at this point. And that's what I mean, where you can't repeal help for people with pre-existing conditions. You're not going to repeal, you know, some assistance for people at the lower end of the income scale. But I think there are ways to repeal what Obamacare is and replace it with a, you know, conservative, more market-based alternative that helps people in those situations. You know, one idea that Republicans have is that you just focus these dollars into high-risk pools. Bobby Jindal's plan, from what I've seen so far, I haven't given it a close analysis, but he only provides $10 billion a year. That's $100 billion over 10 years for these from the federal government to people with pre-existing conditions. From what I've seen so far, I think that's too low. And I'm also skeptical that the way he deals with this, you know, a standard deduction that someone could take into the market to buy health insurance isn't enough to help people. You might need to have a bigger tax credit, but it's good to see this sort of fresh thinking. And I think that that's people on the right and left should agree that it's great. At least we are having this debate now. It's about how to cover people with pre-existing conditions, not whether we should or not. That anyone who's going to replace this, any credible Republican candidate like Bobby Jindal is going to have to put their their plan on the table in 2016. And you're going to have a lot of jockeying among Republicans to say, oh, that's just Obamacare light. You're not really for repeal. My plan's the real conservative alternative. So you'll have a big debate on the Republican Party, and you're going to need to emerge from that Republican primary to be able to have a plan that's going to appeal to the general electorate. So that's going to be really difficult for some Republicans to kind of, you know, navigate that, those difficulties of, on one hand, appealing to conservatives, not being too big government, but also reforming it enough to get it in a more conservative free market direction to cover people with pre-existing conditions and help people out in the lower end of the income scale.
That's going to be fascinating to watch, even as Obamacare continues to look for what altitude here. Clark in Charleston, South Carolina is calling. Hi, Clark, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right. What do you see, Clark?
Well, we have a healthcare company here in South Carolina that did a lot of enrollment through holding sessions, particularly in the restaurant and hospitality trade, which you probably know are the dynamics of that. Those are the people that don't have coverage.
Yep.
You know, your waiters, your waitresses, your people who clean hotels. And I think the pivotal thing that we found out in doing this all over the state of South Carolina is that we had, like one group of the largest restaurant chain we did in South Carolina, we found that of the 500 people that we enrolled, only 10% actually paid the premium. They complete enrollment, but they'd want to think about it and never came back around to actually purchasing the insurance. And I think there are a couple reasons for that. Number one, not ever having it before, there's just a lot of mistrust, number one. And then number two, surprisingly enough, we found that there are a lot of competing government programs with free health clinics that these people have been going to for years and still were and weren't shutting down. So it was competing government programs that were actually causing problems with them ever buying the product.
Clark, you're right out there in the reality of it, and I appreciate that report. I mean, Jack Beatty, it is interesting here. The whole goal is to get people in who have not been insured, meaning they haven't been paying premiums. They don't have that habit. Of course, a lot of employed people, if they're lucky enough, they don't even think about it. It just goes out of the paycheck. But if you've never been in that habit, or if you've found alternatives in your family for many years to that whole world of paid medical care, that may be a steep climb.
It may be, and maybe that'll be reflected in, growing participation in the program. But, you know, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association on Wednesday said that 80 to 85% of the people buying its products, now that's only one company, had already paid by February 1st. So I hear what the caller is saying, that many people aren't paying, but Blue Cross Blue Shield says, well, we're getting nearly, 85% of our people are paying. So we really don't know at this point.
I want to turn to money and politics. The Supreme Court acting again in 2010, it was Citizens United, a lot of corporate money into the world of political campaigning. This week, aggregate limits lifted so that it can go from 100,000 plus to millions, if you've got them, that you can pour into political campaigning that you could not before. Sean McCutcheon was at the heart of that, was the plaintiff in the case that went to the Supreme Court. We talked with him when it went to the court. We talked with him this week after the Roberts Court ruled in his favor. This is a wealthy Alabama businessman. He said he is ready to go out and spend a lot on American political campaigns.
I'm going to celebrate, and I'm going to try to support more than I ever have, and certainly look forward to doing it.
Sean McCutcheon with us right there. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, harshly criticized the Supreme Court's decision to strike down limits on federal campaign contributions.
They wish to dismantle all limits on giving, piece by piece, until we are back to the days of the robber barons, when anyone or anything could give unlimited money, undisclosed, and make our political system seem so rigged that everyone will lose interest in our democracy.
Kristen Welker, where do you see this decision coming from, and what do you see it pushing toward in terms of the practice of American politics?
Well, it's interesting because, of course, this centers on the idea of freedom of speech, the idea that campaign contributions are a form of freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. Where is it going? That's the question. A lot of people are looking at this and saying that this is just going to open the floodgates. You have some Republican lawyers lawyers, some conservative advocates saying that they're thinking about bringing more lawsuits that would give companies, labor unions, the ability to donate directly to candidates. And then on the other hand, you have some Democrats saying that they're going to try to propose legislation that would impose stiffer rules to sort of juxtapose or combat this Supreme Court ruling. It's really hard to see that that's actually going to happen, that will get through Congress. But certainly there is a sense that you are going to see more influence among wealthy donors. Now, the White House, like other Democrats, like Schumer, have denounced the ruling. But interestingly, yesterday during the press briefing here, Jay Carney, you know, said President Obama opposed to the ruling, certainly, but wouldn't answer whether he would actually use the ruling to solicit donations from folks who have maxed out under existing rules.
Well, so, of course, they will. Everybody will now, right?
I mean, right. So it's going to be, but it's interesting that, you know, Carney wouldn't go there. Certainly, I think we're going to see a rise of influence. Will we see a rise of corruption? That's the big question.
John, what do you see here? A flourishing of democracy because money can speak? Or, as Chuck Schumer says, you know, back to the days of the robber barons, a corruption of democracy because it will speak so loudly?
Well, the robber barons, if we want to call them that, have always had the ability to spend almost always had the ability to spend unlimited money, just depended on how they were going to spend that. Since 1976 in Buckley versus Valeo, they said you can't have an absolute limit on what people give. So throughout the years, we've had different things. You know, under McCain-Feingold, it was called the 527s, where George Soros on the left and some other Republicans on the right could spend unlimited amounts of money on these, you know, 527 groups. Now we call them super PACs. And super PACs, I mean, right now you have Tom Steyer, who is an environmentalist, who's going to spend $100 million on the 2014 election alone. Now, under this McCutcheon ruling, what that has done is it's actually just lifted the aggregate amount that someone can give in hard money. Disclosed money is actually the interesting part here, that money given, that's hard money, directly to candidates is disclosed. So this could actually encourage some people who are giving money to these super PACs undisclosed, might now redirect some of that money to individual candidates. Right now, the aggregate limit, if you look at it, it's about $123,000 for an election cycle. You know, if you wanted to max out to all the campaigns and all the candidates at the federal level you wanted to, some analysts have suggested it's now high as $6 million. But again, that $6 million is much less than someone like the Koch brothers or Tom Steyer are spending on super PACs. But the difference is that this money will be disclosed and directly given to candidates rather than to these outside, you know, so-called dark money shadow network groups. It's just a problem in our system. You know, the rich definitely have more of a voice than the poor. And it's just a question of how we're going to regulate that, whether we're going to disclose it or not. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, smaller groups of individuals, labor unions, people around different issues, issue advocacy groups can band together and they can pool their money and spend it as well. So it's a difficult issue. But I think at the end of the day, restricting speech is not the solution to the problem.
Jack, I want to come to you on that, but a lot of listeners on this as well. Dolores in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Dolores, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and guests. I have so much to say, but I'll just say what I think, and then I'll take their answers off the air.
Sure.
Too much money in politics. I don't agree with what the Supreme Court did. Healthcare thing, I haven't had healthcare in years. I have it now. I love Obama for that. It's all so complicated, and I could go on for hours. My husband died because he didn't have healthcare. I'm not going to go on the healthcare issue. I'm talking about the money in politics. So I just want to hear what everyone else has to say about this, but I am so thankful that I now have health care.
And too much money in politics both. Dolores, thanks for your call. One more from Milwaukee, if I may. Nathan. Nathan, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. I want to point out that I found it supremely ironic the very week the U.S. Supreme Court strikes down the campaign finance law. Several communities in my state hold referendums to express support for amending the U.S. Constitution to specifically state that money is not speech, and it passed in each community.
So locally, you're going the other way, while nationally, the Supreme Court is taking off another lid here. Nathan, I appreciate that. And one more from Buffalo, New York. John, you're on.
Hi. Why don't we just cut to the chase and eliminate Election Day and replace it with Auction Day.
Auction Day, highest bidder.
Yes, exactly. This way we would be able to know who is actually running the government. We could assign numbers to all the major donors and corporations. And they could have teams.
Give them a bidding paddle, put them in a bigger golden arena, and off we go. Auction Day instead of Election Day. John in Buffalo, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, what do you make of the Supreme Court this week and all the American concerns about what is going on one way or another with our democracy here?
Well, you know, it's almost as if the Roberts Court is determined to realize here in the USA Aristotle's definition from the ancient world. Oligarchy is when the men of property have government in their hands. You know, will giving, does giving on this scale sway votes in Congress? In a path-breaking paper on the Senate, Larry Bartels found that it was highly responsive to the wealthy, occasionally responsive to the middle class, and totally unresponsive to the wishes of the bottom 30% of Americans. The wealthy speak in the only language senators listen to, money. But for John Roberts, money is speech. Corruption for him means bribes, quid pro quo. He's oblivious of systemic corruption. You know, to paraphrase T.S. Eliot, after such innocence, what forgiveness?
John McCormick, I was talking with a businessman who does a lot of work in Europe, and he said, you know, he loves the United States because it's, you can, I mean, even before this ruling, you can push money so easily into politics. Here, he felt like he can really influence policy in a way that it's much more difficult in other countries around the world. Is this a good thing, or is this that Aristotle oligarchy warning, John?
Well, I think it's important to note that they didn't repeal the cap that can be given to an individual congressman or senator, you know, for example. So a congressman or senator can still only get $5,000 of hard money from an individual.
But again, you can go to the party, the party.
We've got these super PACs already where the super PAC can, you know, indirectly give, you know, yes, tens of millions if he wants to a particular senator and put him in his pocket, essentially. You know, it's not a completely problem-free issue, but I mean, I said, you know, the rich have more of a voice than the poor in the situation, but I do think there is the law of diminishing returns, that the purpose of money in politics is to get your name out there to the people. It is to get your message out there. And I think that the first $10 million in a state Senate race is very important to get your name out there, to get your message out there. But the second $20 million, $10 million, the third, the fourth, at some point, you know, you're, to paraphrase Winston Churchill, you're making the rubble bounce. You're not really getting any benefit out of that. So I think that as more and more money floods into it, you know, at the end of the day, I don't see it having that much of an impact if you're going to spend, you know, an extra $5 million. And again, maybe if the election comes down to half a percentage point, or like we saw in Florida in 2000, you know, a few hundred votes, then it matters. Anything matters at that point. But I think that we overstate sometimes the impact that money has on elections.
So cumulatively, one wonders. Christian Welker, one interesting dynamic here is that this pushes money toward the parties. Whereas before, if you had big money, it was super PACs. This means more power for the parties, Republicans and Democrats, if they're the new receptacle here. How is that likely to change the complexion of our politics, the function of our politics, Kristen?
Well, I think that it's an important point, and the fact that you do have caps on, you know, what can actually be given to individuals. You know, I think that you're going to potentially have parties rallying around some of these big dollar donors. And what's interesting is even prior to this Supreme Court ruling, last weekend in Las Vegas, you had what some were calling the Sheldon Adelson primary, where you had Republican donors, or Republican potential candidates, I should say, you know, going to Las Vegas, trying to win his approval.
The support of a single man, or
exactly the influence of a single man, because they want his support and certainly his dollars. So I think that even prior to this ruling, we are seeing the influence of big dollar donors, and certainly this continues that.
Jack, I wonder if this brings the Republican Party, just for one, into more power here over its own ranks. Does it undercut the Tea Party when the money comes in greater volume to the formal party and less to super PACs? Is that part of the re-mainstreaming of the GOP, maybe?
Well, Reince Priebus, the Republican chairman, seemed mighty happy this week, and perhaps that was the reason. It does give an edge to the parties. And, you know, if you're looking for, as John said, if you're looking for one sort of, you know, mitigation in this wholesale, practically abolition of restraints, it's the parties will have more money to give out, and that does just implicitly tend toward more moderate candidates.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, seismic rumbles on the American West Coast, and in Chile, a deadly earthquake, 8.2, a big one. There was panic in the town of Arica. Microsoft unveiled its own talking digital assistant, its very own Siri this week. Smarter, they say. Her name? Cortana.
Who's your daddy?
Technically speaking, that'd be Bill Gates. No big deal.
Aha. And the Library of Congress chose New American Sounds for its archives. Here's the first hit ever by an African-American singer, George Washington Johnson's 1896 hit on wax cylinder, The Laughing Song. A century and more later, and it's still you kind of can't help laughing. We're talking about a week in the news, another Fort Hood shooting, another Supreme Court ruling on money and politics, GM, Obamacare, Mideast talks at an impasse. Kristen Welker's here from NBC News, John McCormick from the Weekly Standard, and our own Jack Beatty. Afghanistan getting ready for elections this weekend to replace Hamid Karzai. This is a big deal. American troops supposed to be out by the end of this year. They want to leave some behind. No deal with Karzai on that. Here was one election rally on Wednesday. Zalmay Rasool, Ahmed Karzai's favorite, one of three leading presidential candidates, spoke to a crowd of supporters in Kabul.
We will implement law equally on everyone, and no one, including myself, will be allowed to breach the law. If you really decided that someone else can better serve you than me, I will respect your decision, and I will stand beside you.
Voting this weekend, it takes courage. The Taliban has been very active, shooting, bombing, and yet Afghans have been coming out to rallies and lining up to register to vote. Kristen Welker, what's at stake for Afghans and for the United States in this weekend's voting?
Well, I think there's a sense that there is a lot at stake. White House officials see this as an opportunity to move beyond Karzai, an opportunity to strengthen its relationship with the Afghanistan government, and to get an agreement on the BSA. That, of course, determines the troop level post-2014. But before any of that can happen, there needs to be an actual candidate chosen, which means that there could be a runoff after this weekend's
election. Could be months before we know.
Could be months. Could be until June. And there's a practical side to this, which is that the Pentagon needs enough time to plan for how many troops are going to be there, how many are going to come home. So there's an urgency, I think, on the part of the administration, but certainly a desire among those in Afghanistan to feel as though they're moving toward stability. A lot of question marks, though, about whether or not that can actually happen with this election alone, because, of course, corruption still runs rampant there. And as you point out, the Taliban still has a very strong presence there. So I think that's what's at stake. The one bit of encouraging news is that both front runners have said that they will sign on to the BSA agreement. So that is something that White House officials see as a good thing. They're not endorsing any candidate, certainly.
And that would leave, they're hoping, maybe 10,000 troops behind.
About 10,000 troops. That is the figure that has been discussed. Of course, Karzai hasn't signed the BSA agreement, and the White House has threatened to pull out all of its troops. So there is an urgency to get a president in place so that they can move forward with that determination.
John McCormick, we've heard on this show military analysts saying, just leave. Leaving 10,000 behind is leaving, you know, just enough engagement that you can't really fix it, but you're still stuck.
Well, it's a difficult situation. You know, we basically just left Iraq with no status of forces agreement. What we've seen now is the resurgence of al-Qaeda. So it would be a real tragedy, I think, if the gains of our, you know, servicemen and women, were completely lost because we couldn't have worked out a smart, prudent, you know, status of forces agreement. I'm not a military expert, so I'm not sure exactly what the right level is. But I would hope that there's something that could be worked out to make sure that the resurgence of al-Qaeda, a complete takeover of the Taliban, does not happen.
Let's move to the Middle East. John Kerry has put a lot of effort into trying to get serious talks on Middle East peace between the Israelis and Palestinians, saying just today that, well, they've got to have a little reality check there. It looks like those are at an impasse. In Algeria yesterday, the Secretary of State said that Israeli and Palestinian leaders bore ultimate responsibility for preserving some chance of peace.
We will continue, no matter what, to try to facilitate the capacity of people to be able to make peace. But in the end, my friends, as all of you know, you can facilitate, you can push, you can nudge, but the parties themselves have to make fundamental decisions and compromises. The leaders have to lead.
There's John Kerry. We've got Ukraine on the griddle, Jack Beatty. We've got Iran, Iraq, Syria, relations with China, all kinds of things going on. And he has been doubling down and doubling down with effort on Middle East peace. And right now it looks like it's going nowhere, Jack.
Yes, 12 trips, I think, and counting to the Middle East to try to get these talks about a framework going. And they've gone nowhere. And now this latest detour, if not, sabotage of the whole thing by the Palestinians, who are talking about joining international organizations and holding one of them, the International Criminal Court, out as a possibility if the Israelis aren't forthcoming with concessions. You know, people are criticizing Kerry that this has been an excessive effort, that he never had any chance to get anywhere. Why is he investing U.S. prestige? But remember, they're paid to do a job. I mean, George Bush, quote, parked the Middle East. He parked it. We weren't going to push there. And really, I think Mrs. Clinton parked the Middle East in her tenure, not John Kerry. He's tried everything. And that should be something the country, I think, at least for the effort, should be proud of. He's right. We can't want peace and an agreement more than the parties. And it's up to them in the final analysis.
Kristen Welker, in the middle of the week, suddenly there was this big signal that the American sentenced to life in prison in 1987 for passing, quote, suitcases stuffed with classified documents to Israel, Jonathan Pollard would be released as part of this whole diplomatic dance. What was that about, and why was that suddenly on the table? Do you know, Kristen?
Well, and White House officials say Israelis have always wanted that on the table, so it's something that they were discussing to move the talks forward. And as you know,
is that a way
of
saying Israel, if you take some step, we'll give you Pollard? This is a negotiating chip?
Right. If you could, it's a negotiating tactic to move forward with the talks to make sure that things like the release of Palestinian prisoners do take place on time.
Though Israel has said it would not do that ultimately.
Right. And that of course, has not happened, which is part of what's contributed to this current situation, which appears to be a stalemate. And as you know, the White House was really criticized for putting that on the table, the potential release of Pollard, because some lawmakers saying it was an act of desperation, that he was a spy and that he shouldn't be released. So certainly a controversial move, but White House officials point out, look, we haven't released him yet. It's something that Israelis have put on the table. It's always been there. And they say, look, these peace talks aren't dead yet, but they acknowledge this is a major, major roadblock. And I think it becomes to some extent a legacy issue for this president, for the Secretary of State. And particularly when you look at it in the context of Ukraine and Syria, the administration would like to see some movement on this issue, particularly because the president made it one of his signature goals during his first term and secondly during his second term under Kerry.
John McCormick, there was a time when Middle East peace was seen by many as a key to a much bigger puzzle of international relations, stability, peace. Is it still?
I think less and less so. I think no one thinks that, you know, the Iranian crisis or Syria is going to be solved by fixing the intractable dispute between Israelis and Palestinians. And I think the idea that releasing Jonathan Pollard, it's very strange just as a negotiating tactic. You know, the United States is supposed to be the mediator here, facilitating negotiation between two different parties. Mm-hmm. And when you have the mediator sort of offering a concession to one of the parties in exchange for that party to, for Israel to release some more Palestinian prisoners, change some things on settlements. I do think that was more of a sign of desperation or flailing. I don't really fault the administration for that. It's an incredibly intractable problem, but it's not an encouraging development or a big breakthrough.
Let's go to our listeners, Craig in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. What are you thinking about, Craig?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What's the incentive for the government to inspect car companies or anything the way they should, when they can fine millions and billions of dollars against a company? It's just a microcosm of what goes on in this country.
Well, you're talking about Toyota, GM in the hot seat this week, but the Department of Justice with a billion-plus fine against Toyota for not coming forth quicker with its recall. Well, you think it's a government cash machine? Just wait and make a billion instead of doing their job and saving lives?
Yeah. Is it all about the money? Boy, like, duh.
I don't know where to go with that exactly, Jack Beatty. There was Mary Barra this week. She was fairly unflappable under hours of 2 days of testimony on Capitol Hill. But the facts, as far as we know them, did not look good for GM here, and not particularly good for the National Highway Transportation Authority either, that's supposed to oversee safety in the automobile industry.
No, and as to the latter, its director answered a question: was he aware that his agency could subpoena documents from the companies? And he said he was not aware of that. I mean, that is a very
peculiar.
Yes, and you know, that's some evidence, perhaps, for John's point. I don't know, but and certainly Mary Barra, we're looking into it. We're looking into it. The senators, the Congress people, were having no time for that at all.
John, do you see this as just a flash in the pan story this week, or is GM in trouble with the federal government here?
I think they're in trouble. I mean, if you look at the timeline, this has been over years and years. And GM's going to have to answer for why it took them so, so long to finally issue that recall. And the government's going to have to explain it. I mean, the tables are going to turn eventually, where the government's going to have to, you know, investigate the NHTSA to say, well, why didn't this spark an investigation when these problems were first reported? I mean, many, many people who are experts in this field say that the initial complaints should have triggered an investigation. That didn't happen, and we don't know why.
I want to go to Tony in Springfield, Illinois, truck driver on the road maybe, and thinking about this week's news. Tony, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind, Tony?
Okay. On the politics, my opinion would be is what the politician did in his past and what he stands for, instead of how much money they can spend for commercials and flyers you get in the mail. Second one would be Obamacare. Listen to analysts talk of if the 7 million people that have signed up, they study how many have pre-existing conditions to how many healthy ones. The rate will change dramatically in 2014 if they get too many with pre-existing conditions.
Yeah, everybody's worried about that. Tony, let me ask you about the Supreme Court decision. Do you think they went the right way in lifting another limit on campaign contributions, political?
No, I do not.
Tony, I appreciate your call. 8 in 10 Americans I saw in a poll this week agree with Tony on wanting to control rather than unleash political spending. But there we are. A lot of callers here on what we've been talking about. One more right here. Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Jim, you're on.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, what are you thinking?
I'd like to talk about the Fort Hood shooting. I spent some time in the military myself, you know, and I don't want to say that health care is great. I've had my own struggles there. But I think the big downfall is the chain of command there for that individual soldier for not identifying that issue to begin with and his fellow soldiers.
But is it that obvious, Jim? You know, are we always going to know when somebody's having trouble, in trouble?
Well, you won't always know, but you spend every single day with these people all day long and trust them with your life. You know, you expect to be able to identify these issues a little bit sooner before they start just going off shooting people.
Yeah, that would sure be great, and everybody at Fort Hood wishing for that right now as well. One more right here. Thank you, Jim. Nashville, Tennessee. Jim in Nashville, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in on something that is a continuing thorn in my side with respect to automobile safety, which, of course, tangentially is in the news now with GM.
Yeah.
You know, we have spent and we continue to spend billions upon billions of dollars on automotive safety equipment, both hardware and software, but we spend almost nothing on driver education. And 95% of people don't even know how to properly adjust their side view mirrors, according to the Society of Automotive Engineers. So just a comment. Wish we could see some investment in that side of safety.
Jim, I've got it. Of course, you know, you can spend a lot on a young person teaching them driver's ed, and great for that. But if the ignition fails them and the car can't be steered and the airbags don't work and they're lost to you, I guess no amount of training is going to overcome that. I want to ask about the torture report that's hanging out there this week. The Senate has put this together. It's been sidelined for a year and more, Jack Beatty. CIA has not wanted it to come out. A big, long report, lots of detail. Shocking, we have heard, it will be to Americans if and when it comes out. Do you expect that to see the light of day soon, Jack? And if it does, with what impact?
Well, I don't know about soon. I've heard people say June. I've heard people say later. And impact, I think, really depends upon how much is redacted. That's what Dianne Feinstein seemed to be saying. If the CIA cuts out too much of it, maybe the impact will be less. But there have already been leaks from it. The Washington Post this week had a major leak on what's in it. And yes, the details about the severity of its methods, that it overstated the significance of what it had found, that it took peace credit for information that it did not elicit, some of the details on interrogation involved using truncheons and, of course, waterboarding, and then, of course, famous moment in the movie Zero Dark Thirty that depicts a detainee slip under duress as the moment when we found out who the courier was to bin Laden. According to Dianne Feinstein, the CIA detainee who provided that information provided it prior to the coercive techniques, and that's what the report would show. So there's a lot that's going to come out and will give a massive black eye to the CIA.
Still a lot of conflict over whether or not or how much will come out there. Christian Welker, where's the White House on that? Do they want this report released or not?
Well, they say they want it released. They are highlighting the fact that this took place prior to President Obama taking office. I am told by White House officials it's going to come out expeditiously. I say, what does that mean? They say several weeks, several months. I think Jack is right. We could expect it by June, maybe a little later.
A tidal wave of detail, no doubt, at that point, and we will revisit that whole difficult era in American interrogation / torture. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Kristen Welker, White House correspondent for NBC News. It's always terrific to have you, Kristen. Thanks so much for joining us. John McCormick, The Weekly Standard. Great to have you, John. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beattie, have a great weekend, my friend. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.